Welcome back to the Soundtracker Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peacock. This has been a cursed introduction. It's taken me like 12 tries to record this. I'm hoping that it works out this time. The last one went really well, and then I found out when I was editing it at the end that the internet had dropped out about 10 seconds before I finished it. So I'm doing Cool as Ice today, and I'm joined by Stuart Wellington of the Great Flophouse Podcast. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining, and I hope you enjoy it. If you've been with me since the beginning, as always, thank you so much. If this is your first time, you can follow along with the show over on Twitter at Soundtracker with an underscore at the end. Also, once again, I want to remind you that there's a Patreon for the show now. You can find that over at www.patreon.com/soundtracker. For as little as $3 a month, you can help keep this show going and you get a few bonuses. For $6 a month, you get 2 bonus episodes and you also help keep the show going. So check it out. Like I said, those things keep the lights on here. The first 2 bonus episodes will be coming out within a few days of this episode also. And those are going to be Transformers the Movie and Tank Girl. All right, I think I've said enough here. I'm going to get to the episode. I think you'll all enjoy this because this movie was very fun and the conversation about it was also very fun. And I think that that shows in the conversation. So if you've not seen Cool as Ice, you really should. And I think you'll see why when you listen to this episode. All right, enjoy.
Ain't no use running. Nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs, the soundtrack are gonna track you down. Oh yeah.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to the Soundtracker Podcast. I am joined today by comedian and podcaster Stuart Wellington. Stuart, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I forgot to add voice actor in Psycho Gorman, which was like one of my favorite movies of 2020. So that's really awesome.
Voice actor, bar owner, comedian. Oh, man, my credits. They have no ending.
Jack of all trades.
I'm a jack of a couple of trades. That's I don't oversell it.
Hey, just take the compliment, okay? All right, so this one came about a little differently. This is the point in the show where I'd usually say, what made you choose this movie? But this one came about, so I want to try to do more movies like this, more that aren't just like The Crow or Godzilla. And Cool as Ice felt like a really fun one to do. And I'm a big fan of Flophouse. One of the things I really like about Flophouse, and another reason it was like the first thing that I went to, was because on that show, you could tell that there's a love for what you're talking about. It doesn't feel like it's easy to just be mean about something. You know what I mean? And I think you all tread that line very well, where it's like, it's funny, but there's that, you know, it's all gentle prodding on that show. And I really like that. And it's like, it's easy to take a movie like Cool as Ice and just lay into it.
I feel like it requires no sense of humor or ability to understand art to lay into it, because I would argue that Cool as Ice is a good movie.
No, I agree with you. I can't wait to get going on this because I didn't know how you felt about it going into this. I always like finding this out. I can't believe that Cool as Ice has not found like a cult audience at this point.
I'm sure it has.
But not to the level of like, I hate throwing out The Room as an example, but like it's not one of those yet. And it feels like it should be. And I talked about this on the Black Roses episode I did with Simon Barrett.
That movie rules.
I know, it's so great. I'm way past the idea of so bad it's good. I hate that sort of phrase. And I kind of use, you know how they'll talk about like actors or like a person who they call them like not handsome in a classical way or something like that. Like, I feel like movies like this are not good in the classic sense, but like, it's a great movie. I love Cool as Ice. So I'm glad you're the one that I reached out to. Now, let me ask you this. How familiar with Cool as Ice are you? Because I had actually not seen it. It came out in 1990. So I probably saw it when I was 11 was the last time I saw it.
Yeah. So Cool as Ice is a movie that they, you know, they made about a year after Vanilla Ice, his like popularity peaked. To the Extreme, is that his, was that his big album?
Yeah.
And the movie came out, and I think I'm from a town in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and the local theaters did not play Cool as Ice. And by the time I got around to watching it on VHS, I think it was definitely a few years after, and it we definitely knew it was going to be, you know, like a quote unquote bad movie. And I remember watching it in a buddy's basement and, you know, having some laughs at some of the goofy parts and not really thinking too much of it, but not like, I don't know, you know, not having a strong connection. And then, you know, a little bit ago, a friend of ours here in Brooklyn who programs the movie slate over at the Nighthawk Cinema, she asked me and my co-host Dan McCoy to host a screening of it. And it was an almost sold out small theater. And Dan had never seen it at all, and I didn't remember it. And it was really great to rewatch. And watching it now, I like to put it in the words of my buddy Dan. It's a movie that, like, if they had asked like David Lynch to direct this movie, it would be the exact same. If they asked like an acclaimed comedy director to make it, they couldn't have made it better than what it is. Like if David Lynch had directed it, it would have been the same movie. Like, there's something kind of special about it. And the fact that it's shot by, Janusz Kaminski, Academy Award nominated? And did he win? I don't know. Guy works with Spielberg did the cinematography. So it looks great.
Right. And David Kellogg, who, if you look at David Kellogg, who's disowned this film since then, the director, but you can tell that he got his chops in music videos because that's like a lot of what he did prior to making this movie. Because,
yeah,
first of all, the movie opens with a music video. Like that's
and ends with a music video.
You know, the only other thing he's done feature film wise is that Inspector Gadget movie with Matthew Broderick. And this is the one that he disowned. So we got to be around the same age then. The way you're talking here, we're probably very similar in age. And I, as a kid, you know, Vanilla Ice was like the coolest dude in the world.
He's got ice in his name.
And I saw this movie as a kid, and I remember even like back then, my young brain wasn't ready for it.
Did you get your hair cut like Vanilla Ice?
No, my mom wouldn't let me.
Oh, okay. I had at least one friend who did the haircut. I, you know, at the time, I was more of an MC Hammer guy. And then by the time this movie came around, I feel like Vanilla Ice had already become kind of a joke. And, like, you know, people would laugh at how he dressed and all that stuff. And, like, watching the movie now, I'm like, damn, I kind of wish I had his clothes.
Yeah, the leather pants and Zubas. I can't get over what a good look that is.
Yeah. A lot of Stussy shirts and that jacket with all the fucking phrases on it.
He's got a hat with like a belt buckle on the front.
Hell yeah. He's like a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure character. It's amazing.
Okay. But you and I seem to feel very similarly about this movie, and I had not seen it since then. And watching it now, look, I'm not going to sit here and argue that like it's like some sort of like piece of art, but it is never at any point is this movie boring. The worst thing a movie could be is boring. It is never boring.
Yeah.
Again, it is shocking to me that this isn't one that has like midnight screenings. I can't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a piece of art. It's probably not like pure cinema, but it's definitely something that's trying to do something. And I think like I read somewhere that the inspiration to make this movie was that a rival studio was in the process of producing Boys in the Hood, which featured Ice Cube, and the talent agency that backed Vanilla Ice is like, we need to get in on this bandwagon, this trend. So we need to get Vanilla Ice in his own movie. And obviously, let's say to a lesser level of success.
Well, looking at the time, I couldn't remember the time frame that this came out. I literally thought this was like a month after Ice Ice Baby is what it felt like to me. But you brought up a really good point. And that is, so SBK was his record label. And SBK, yeah, they saw Ice Cube's involvement in Boys in the Hood and were like, we're going to make a project for Vanilla Ice. But the problem is, this movie was doomed from jump. Because as you said, he had peaked a year prior. And by this point, I mean, his fall came fast and hard when it came, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in 1990, he like dated Madonna. He was on Saturday Night Live, but that backlash came hard and it came fast. You know, Third Base, Arsenio Hall, like everyone taking shots at Vanilla Ice. And I mean, it was 3 years between To the Extreme and his follow-up album. And the only thing they put out in between was this really lazy live album. So his cultural cash was already really, really dwindled. And they decided to take a chance on this movie anyways. And there was no chance it was going to do well. Now, the thing that I feel bad about watching this is you get this feeling watching it that Vanilla Ice thought this was like he seems blissfully unaware that like this was going to be the nail in the coffin for him. You know, like this was it for him. This was what did it. And it didn't take much of a nudge to get him to that point. Cause as we said, you know, his popularity had already dwindled, but like, I don't think he realized that this was going to have these sort of ramifications that it had for his career, because this was that final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, watching this, though, I don't like, though he is, you know, the primary force of this movie, I don't see him as having much control. Like, I feel like he is this creature, this like element that just arrives and people react around him. And he is kind of blissfully unaware, like you said, of just like everything. So I think there's more of a sense of like, oh, yeah, so I'm going to be an actor now. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to be an actor. Who knows? Rather than being like, I have a clear idea of what my career is, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like he's this like beautiful, somewhat, let's say, medium talented kind of idiot. No offense, but I mean, come on. You know, like, I feel like he didn't have the level of talent to back up his level of fame, and that's why he fell so quickly. But maybe, who knows? Maybe I'm just talking up my ass.
No, and you're completely right. And his label realized that. And basically what this movie was them trying to wring out a little bit of extra money out of him before that bottom fell out.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it backfired big time in their faces. Vanilla Ice actually got paid $1 million to do this. So really, he's the only one who came out okay from this movie.
And us, the viewers, who get to enjoy it.
All right. Well, actually, now that we're talking about figures here, let me get into the background for the weekend that it came out. So it opened at 13th place on October 18th, 1991. Yeah, it did not. $1.2 million back on a $6 million budget is all it made the entire theatrical run.
Okay.
Which is a little bit more than Vanilla Ice got paid to be in it.
Yeah.
So the movies, the top 10 the weekend that it came out were this. Number one was Other People's Money.
Okay.
Number two is Frankie and Johnny.
Okay.
Number three was The Fisher King.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Some heavy hitters.
Number four was Ricochet, which is actually another
word. Okay. Yeah. That's a good one.
Number five was Ernest Scared Stupid.
That movie is a goddamn banger right there. I saw that movie like three times in the theater. I'm the nail in Cool as Ice's coffin.
This was like its third week and it still plays like significantly higher than Cool as Ice.
It's a great movie.
Oh, I love it. I love it because I was born at the right time.
Yeah.
Number six was Little Man Tate.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember that one with Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I know The Fisher King, but the top two I never saw and only vaguely remember.
Yeah, I actually had to look a couple of these up because I was like, I don't remember this one. And one of those was Frankie and Johnny. That's Pacino and Pfeiffer. But number seven was Deceived. That's Goldie Hawn and John Hurt.
Okay.
Yeah. Number eight was Paradise, a Don Johnson movie.
Okay.
Number nine was Necessary Roughness.
Yeah, I saw that one.
I like that movie. And then actually 10 is one that I love. Shattered with Tom Berenger and Bob Haskins.
Whoa, I don't think I ever saw that. I'll check it out.
It's cool. It's a thriller. It's got a bunch of twists. Some of them get fairly absurd, but it's
I gotta say, just listening to this slate, there were a lot of like adult thrillers and adult movies in this list.
Yeah, it wasn't vanilla. Look, Cool as Ice didn't stand a chance. And then and then Ernest Scared Stupid.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a fucking awesome movie.
Okay. And then a few other things. So as far as casting goes, Lisa Marie Presley, Winona Ryder. This is a huge list here. Lisa Marie Presley, Winona Ryder, Jennifer Connelly, Drew Barrymore, Shannon Doherty, Jennifer Aniston, Uma Thurman, Martha Plimpton, Courtney Cox, Jenny Garth, and Tori Spelling all turned down the role of Kathy.
Wow, that's a surprise. They didn't want to be awoken in their bed with an ice cube in their mouth.
Oh, God, I can't wait to talk about the movie. Gwyneth Paltrow took the role of Kathy, and then her dad advised her against it, fearing it would harm her career. And then the last little funny little thing I found, some enterprising soul out there collected all the things that are embroidered on Johnny's jacket.
Yeah.
Danger.
Uh-huh.
Down by Law.
Uh-huh.
Breeze. Hype. Ice. Lust. Ah, yeah, with an exclamation point at the end.
Uh-huh.
Roll In, Sex Me Up, Yep, Yep, a question mark, Dope, and the letters JK surrounded by stars. So I don't know how many times they had to like freeze frame this movie to find all of those, but thank God for them.
I feel like that jacket's got to be in a Planet Hollywood somewhere.
I bet Vanilla Ice kept it. He's so proud of everything he's ever done. Like, he like still gets super stoked about being in Ninja Turtles. Like,
yeah, I mean, considering if those are the two movies he was in, I mean, I'm sure he's been in other things, but if these are the two movies that he is known for, that's not bad. That's a better hit rate than a lot of folks.
Well, look, for people of a certain age, like Ninja Turtles 2 is a super, no, I can't even say for people of a certain age, my friends' kids who are like 5 and 6 now love those movies too. Like, Ninja Turtles have had a shockingly long life. And you know, there are generations now who are like discovering Ninja Rat because their parents had them watch Ninja Turtles 2.
And they're essential building blocks to the furry community. I mean, thumbs up to the early Ninja Turtle movies.
Okay, so we'll talk the movie here in just 1 second. But the last thing I want to say about this is, if you're listening and you've never seen Cool as Ice, let me just give you a brief breakdown of what the plot is. Vanilla Ice plays a guy named Johnny, who is like a bad boy rapper motorcycle rider, who breaks down in a small town and falls for the like straight A student, you know, wrong side of the tracks movie. However, the twist with this one is Kathy, the girl that he falls for, has a family who is in witness protection. So what makes this so weird is the movie's tonally all over the place. Like, there's not really any dramatic heft to this movie. Like, it doesn't try really, other than the like love story, which is like the one part where it sags really is during the love story. But it's like this cross between Rebel Without a Cause, Lifetime drama, and like a TGIF comedy. So it's like so weird. The tone makes no sense together. But again, that's what makes this so fun. Like, Vanilla Ice is a fairly charismatic guy, even though he's not a great actor. Like, you can see why they maybe thought, hey, maybe this will springboard him into something. If this happens, if this gambit pays off, maybe he'll have an acting career. Like I said, not a great actor, but he's trying his best.
And the thing is, again, to continue the trend of how I've described this movie, I feel like if you had gotten an experienced comedy actor, put him in this role and been like, do some weird, funny stuff, you'd be hard pressed to do a better job at delivering your lines strangely than Vanilla Ice does. Like, he gives this, turns into like a grade A comedy performance. It's unintentional, I'm sure, but it's still amazing.
Well, when I put the title card together for this episode, I was like cracking up just at every image. And like that part where he comes across Kathy and Nick for the first time, and he does the infamous drop that zero and get with the hero. He is such a weirdo in this movie. Johnny is an incredible weirdo in this movie.
Yeah.
The character is chaotically weird.
Yeah.
like you said, nobody could put in a performance as good because people would try to ham it up. But what makes it work is that Vanilla Ice isn't trying that. You know, like, he's being serious, but all of his choices are so strange. And it fits with the character, who is, as I said, a massive weirdo, which is something I realized watching this last night. Like, the entire movie, I was like, this dude is so fucking weird.
And part of it, I could be wrong, but I'm guessing playing a character who is a rapping motorcycle enthusiast, I mean, I'm assuming he is not that different than the character of Johnny. I don't think that this is a huge stretch for him to play this character. I'm sure there's an interview with him somewhere where he's talking about the differences, where he's like, Johnny puts his shoes on left foot first, but Ice puts his shoes on right foot first. But I'm assuming they're fairly similar, and that's why he's like, he gives such a perfect natural performance.
Which is, I mean, if you've not seen this movie, hearing this performance called natural is just so funny. Like you said, the ice cube in the mouth thing, like there's so many weird choices they do with his character. We'll get to those. So the title sequence with this movie, first of all, lets you know exactly what year it is, because it's that like yellow, red, white lettering, like big block lettering that was really big. Like, I think of like in Living Color, like the TV show in Living Color, like basically use that title sequence. Fear of a Black Hat, use that title sequence. But yeah, then it starts with this music video, which I was a little worried going into it last night, because like I said, the worst thing a movie could be to me is boring. So when you've got a 6 minute long opening credit sequence in your already fairly short movie, I was like, oh shit. Like, I don't know if this is going to be stuffed with like a bunch of filler, but
yeah, No, it's not. It's all gas, no brakes. No, but that opening credit scene is a music video that's just people dancing in a warehouse. Very good. It seems like the opening to like a TV show that is just extended and like an MTV thing. Like, it's great.
Oh yeah, and like Naomi Campbell's in it. Like, it's crazy.
Naomi Campbell definitely is in it.
But once the credit sequence is open, the good shit starts immediately. Like, it's, you know, and just before there's even a line of dialogue, he's got that weird tic-tac-toe haircut. Like I said, that belt buckle hat, the license plate, that close-up of his license plate, where instead of a state like Ohio or whatever, it says state of mind, where the state is. Like, that was the moment that I was like, oh, hell yes. Like, I am in for something here.
Yeah, he's great.
And then the next scene is him riding next to her on a motorcycle.
And real quick, the opening song here is the intro music. It's Cool as Ice, Everybody Get Loose, right? Is that?
Yeah, the very first song on the soundtrack. It was one of the singles off of this album. And again, we'll get to it. We talked the soundtrack itself, but I like that song.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's upbeat. It works.
And I'm going to say it now, too. Ice Ice Baby, now that we're like 30 years beyond the peak, I like Ice Ice Baby. That sample's inspired. You know, I could probably go without ever hearing it again, but it's easy to understand why Ice Ice Baby was a huge hit if you listen to it now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then there's like four times in this movie, and one of them is right at the beginning where he's riding next to her on the horse and it's slow motion, and he flirts with the new girl by leaping his motorcycle in front of her horse.
Mm-hmm.
But there are like four times in this movie where he jumps on a ramp where there's not a ramp or an incline in sight. Like, he just superhuman strength lifts his motorcycle 7 feet into the air and leaps like a car, a fence. And I love it so much that they didn't even put any thought into like, let's put a ramp here. We're just going to show the end of the jump.
Movie magic.
Now, the only time that I think that this movie doesn't do well, because, you know, you talked about how if they put a comedic, the worst, you know, you watch a lot of bad movies, and the worst type of bad movie is a bad comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the times that this movie doesn't do well, like, I love Sidney Lassick, great character actor, but that part where they're with him at the beginning and they're like talking about the motorcycle getting fixed, because the motorcycle breaks down, they need to get it fixed. And it's like circus music in the background, and they're really trying to let you know that this scene is supposed to be funny.
Ham it up. Yep.
That's when it gets bad. But then you've got, you know, like, there's a bunch of chaotic montages in this too. Like, when they're waiting for the motorcycle to get fixed, and it's just like Vanilla Ice is outside dancing. Deezer D's genuinely great. One of his buddies, he played Stabmaster Arson in CB4.
Right.
He's the weird friend eating that weird, like, anchovy and like pineapple sandwich in the house.
Right. Okay. Okay.
But there's no explanation in this movie for how Johnny finds Kathy's house with the infamous drop that zero and get the hero line. Like,
yes.
So like, he shows up in this town
with his small gang, and they are all colorfully dressed. And they show up in, you know, like classic suburbs, classic white bread suburbs, and they bring a little bit of personality. And of course, they're immediately drawn to the mechanic's house, which is also a little bit kitschy, to say the least.
Yeah, I like those two characters. Like, they were just like the sweet old people that like hung out with them and thought they were cool too. So like, I enjoyed the characters, just not when they tried to make them comic relief.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, and the house is so bizarre. There's so many weird choices in this movie. You know, and then he shows up at her house. He steals her black book. Like I said, Johnny's like a really weird creep in this movie.
Yes.
There's no explanation why he gets there. But that's where you kind of get the idea that David Kellogg's a music video guy, because then, speaking of weird montages, there's the part where it's just like the family like doing things forward and reverse in the house, like dancing in the house. Michael Gross like pulling the paper down and kissing his wife, and like weird pans and frantic cuts. It's just again, such a weird movie, but that's when you learn that her family is in witness protection. And what a weird angle, because, like, you know, when you hear witness protection, you assume that, like, it's mafia or something.
Mm-hmm.
But get the explanation for it, that it's because her father turned in crooked cops. It's, like, the last thing that I expected.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty wild. He turned in crooked cops, and he's, what, an accountant?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was a former cop himself. But if you're looking at what you're supposed to swallow here with this movie,
Yeah.
It's that Michael Gross's character turned in crooked cops who somehow have the manpower to like hunt him across the country 24/7. And they find him because in this small town that he got relocated to, he was on a local news station in the background while his daughter got an award. They had that many men on this case that they found him in whatever small town this is supposed to be.
I mean, this is pre-internet, baby. Like, you had to have guys on that constantly if you wanted to track these people down.
You speaking from experience, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yep. Back in the day, I worked for the mob, and I had to watch TV all the time, mainly local programming, hoping to find people that are in witness protection. I never found anyone, but I made a decent little bit of money that summer.
Okay, so let's break down what a weirdo Johnny is. Like, we've kind of been hinting at it, but like, I think it's like screamingly funny to me that in this movie, he's supposed to be the coolest guy in the world. But then he says things like, I'm going to go across the street and sling a schlong while he's in that leather jacket and like hypercolor Zubas pants.
Yes.
And he looks so absurd in that townie bar when he's standing in that townie bar and his hair's like as tall as he is. And he's like giving like really weird serial killer stares to Kathy. And then he gives the most low energy performance of the song People's Choice that I've ever seen in my life. Like the crowd, usually in those movies, like the crowd gets into it. And they're like clapping in the background. But like,
I feel like no one is into it at all.
This is just for him and Kathy. It's like a performance specifically for Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene that got me the most is the one you mentioned earlier where she's sleeping in her bed.
Yes.
All of a sudden you see his dripping wet hand. Mind you, just before this scene, he's supposed to have beaten up like six people. So he's probably still got like jerk boyfriend germs.
Yeah. Germs all over him. And her bedroom is very like, there's a lot of art into the design of it. Everything is kind of set at a weird angle. It's really great. It's it is the kind of bedroom. It is, this is not your typical overachieving high school girl's bedroom.
Yeah, and he drops an ice cube in her mouth while she's asleep. Which, if someone did that to me, I would be like, "That's fucking disgusting."
Yeah,
but she's into it. She's into every time he sneaks into her room or like does weird stalker shit. Like, she loves it.
Yeah, and it's big fan of true crime. This one.
Did you notice this? Her little brother in this movie is the kid who plays Timmy Timmons in The Sandlot and was also Dennis the Menace in that surprisingly funny Dennis the Menace movie with Walter Matthau as Mr. Wilson.
Yeah, I couldn't place the kid, but he was recognizable. I just couldn't remember what it was from, but that's not a huge surprise. I mean, we do have Michael Gross. He's a big name.
But the fight scene. Okay. I talked about the fight scene, but we didn't like get into the fight scene. So her dickhead boyfriend, Nick, mind you, that actor is a tremendous dickhead boyfriend character.
Yeah.
Like, he just looks like a dick, but he shows up at a parking lot where they're destroying not Johnny's motorcycle, but his homeboy's motorcycle. Uh-huh. And I say homeboy because one of the funniest lines in the movie is when he asks him, whose motorcycle is it? And Johnny says, my homeboy's. And he says, well, homeboy this, right before he swings a baseball bat.
Yeah.
And then Johnny turns into Steven Seagal like he's doing arm bars.
Yeah. Yeah, he does it all. Yeah, he clearly comes from the wrong side of the tracks. And on that side of the tracks, there's a martial arts school.
Another really funny line in this movie is when she asks him, what's important to you? And he says, if you ain't true to yourself, you ain't true to nobody, which is like a legendary non-answer to that question.
Yeah, that's some quality toxic male shit.
That's the most important thing to him. But another weird montage. Again, there's so many. I'm just kind of like running through my notes. Is when they're at the construction site and like their idea of a date is going to like a construction site with like dangerous equipment everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Just like this weird shot of them chasing each other through it and him doing like.
I love it. It was so great. Yeah, it's the like they play the love theme to Cool as Ice. It's man, it's awesome.
And at the end, another example of Johnny being weird. Their first kiss, when she kisses him, he very clearly goes,
yes.
When you eat a good pizza or something, he's like,
yes. Yes, he's a weird dude. But like playing around the construction site matters because that comes into play later on, right?
Oh, yeah.
That is tied in with the finale. So it makes sense to include it in the plot. It doesn't make sense for like a first date, But I don't know. I haven't been on a first date in a long time. Maybe that's what kids do nowadays.
Well, no, this is 1990. It would be nowadays.
Oh, then I guess kids back in 19, I mean, back in 1990, we would just like go out in the woods.
The mall. Uh-huh. So another thing that cracks me up about this is that Michael Gross, up to this point, you still kind of think that maybe he had mob connections. But yeah, even knowing that, like, it's crooked cops, that her dad thinks a, like, 20-year-old who's dressed like Poochie from Itchy and Scratchy is a member of the mob, or when you find the reality of it, that he's, like, friends with these crooked cops, is always so funny that the entire time he's just like, I don't trust him. I saw him talking to those guys. He's got to be with them. Like, he looks nothing like them. These guys are in, like, dress suits. They look like mob people. And again, like I said, he's wearing like a giant leather hat.
Yeah, it's one of those things where Michael Gross is trying to convince everyone that Johnny is playing four-dimensional chess. And we're like, I don't buy it, buddy.
Well, and then it, I guess, leads us to the big conflict at the end here, where Kathy's little brother develops this sort of Thurman Merman to Willie in Bad Santa stalker relationship with Johnny, where he's like obsessed with him, even though he shouldn't be, like, gets the same haircut as him, wants to ride on the motorcycle with him.
That makes sense, though. Like, I feel like, I mean, Vanilla Ice had that effect on a lot of kids.
Now, one of the, like, really, truly funny parts in this movie, it intentionally funny, because like I said, you know, I think we both realize that when we talk about how much we love this movie and how funny it is, it maybe is not in the way director David Kellogg was intending.
Uh-huh.
But again, I don't want to sound like I'm beating up with this movie, and I think we both made it abundantly clear that, like, we're not, like, we both have a pretty big soft spot for this movie. But the one part where I was absolutely laughing with the movie is during that motorcycle ride, when her little brother gives a finger to her ex-boyfriend while he's sitting in that car at the stoplight, and he's got that giant bandage over his face. Like, I actually laughed about that. But then you know, he sneaks into Kathy's room again to throw his ring into her fishbowl. Like, he's such a freak. Like, he broke up with her by throwing a ring into her fish tank while no one's home. And it's so funny how everything sort of domino effects into making it look like Johnny is the guilty party.
Yeah.
And he leaves just as the bad guys are kidnapping Tommy, the little brother. Like, he's completely worthless. Like, he doesn't do anything to help. Like, he's just, everywhere he goes, he causes problems.
Yeah, Johnny's behavior is creepy to the point that it can be easily confused with actually dangerous.
Yeah, like, do a little exercise here. Imagine if this movie were made in 2022 and the same choices were made with Johnny's character.
Who's the Vanilla Ice equivalent of 2022?
Post Malone.
Yeah, I was going to guess that too. He seems nice. I don't know. Yeah, Post Malone. He's had some staying power, though. Wow.
Yeah, that's the one difference. I said Post Malone and immediately thought to walk it back because, you know, Post Malone is going to be around for a while, it seems like. He's in it for the long haul.
He's still got space on his face to get tattoos, so, like, I don't think he's going anywhere.
That is a good question, though. I'm curious as to who, if they made like a Cool as Ice in 2022, there hasn't really been like a flash in the pan person in a while, I feel like.
You know, I'm a 42-year-old man, and I do buy a lot of new music, but the vast majority of music that I buy and seek out is extreme heavy metal. So when it comes to non-extreme heavy metal music that's current, it's usually like stuff I'll see on Saturday Night Live or something. So I'm definitely not an authority in modern pop music.
So what you're saying is you have like a bunch of heavy metal and like Father John Misty is like your album collection.
Well, I don't buy Father John Misty, but I'm aware of who, I don't even know if I'm aware of who Father John Misty is, but I feel like I would ask mutual friend Howell Dawdy to explain who that is.
I actually like Father John Misty, and the only reason I brought him up is because it's the only musical guest I can think of that I tuned in for on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, right. I mean, Saturday Night Live remains to be probably the worst show that I've seen every episode of. So if it's a musical guest, I'll watch at least a couple moments of the performance before slamming that fast forward button.
Okay, so I'm curious to see how you feel about this soundtrack when we get to it, because it is most certainly not metal music. But okay, so to finish up with the movie, though, so Johnny, in the most doofus move in history of movies, walks up to the house and picks up that package. For whatever reason, he decides the best move is to pick up a package on the porch and hand it to the dad. And that package has the ransom tape.
Yeah.
It's just so funny how everything works out against Johnny's favor at the end. And the thing is, there's like overwhelming evidence at that point that he's the one that kidnapped Tommy. Like, it is every piece of evidence that could work against him. And yet Kathy refuses to believe it at that point. So she's the one who's being ridiculous.
And he, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I feel so bad for this guy that's caught up in this web of intrigue. But like, if he wasn't acting like such a weirdo all the time, this wouldn't have happened. Like, right. If he had, similar to Vanilla Ice's performance, if he hadn't made the exact wrong decision at all times, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, he didn't have to go pick her brother up and take him on a motorcycle ride. He didn't have to pick up, who the fuck picks up someone's mail on their porch and hands it to him? Like, a suspicious envelope, a manila envelope, like, oh, here, you want this. Like, just leave it for them to find themselves. You don't know what the fuck's in there. I would think that was bad news if I saw it.
Yeah.
But then the thing is, this might be the funniest part in the entire movie to me. Despite proving over and over that he's a total idiot, he figures out where Tommy is based on the sound on that tape, which plays into Chekhov's construction site.
Yep, that's it. That's how he figures it out.
He stays on brand by not knowing the term construction site, because he's like, he's at that place. What's it called? And he's like, the construction site. And he's like, that's it.
He's like, yeah, construction site. Yep.
But then you get the ending where the whole gang comes together to take out baddies with their motorcycles. And there's like musical flourishes and bird chirping sounds when they get knocked out. And then he once again jumps on an invisible ramp on Nick's car, and everyone wins. And we get another music video to close us out. So, like, I can't stress enough, I want this movie to find the audience it deserves at this point. But now that audience is not going to be for everyone. This is certainly not a movie for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, this falls like over at the old Flophouse, the podcast that I normally review movies on. This kind of falls into the category of something we would call a movie you kind of like, or even a good bad movie. Like a movie that, like, you might not watch it on your own, but if you want to get some friends together and like watch a movie together and laugh, or maybe you see it's playing at your local theater, it's a fun movie to watch with an audience and kind of laugh at all the silly stuff and enjoy it.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And I think the reason that I don't like the idea of the, like, so bad it's good is because if I could put a movie on when I'm having a bad day, as I was yesterday when I watched this movie last night, it was like a really bad day where like a storm destroyed a whole bunch of shit at work. And I came and put this on and it put me in a good mood. And it's hard for me to call something like that bad. If I enjoy something, I don't like even throwing the term, but for the sake of this, most people call them, as you said, good, bad movies are so bad they're good. And it is fitting. It's just one of those things where, like, guilty pleasure I've tried to stay away from too, but you're 100% right. It is like almost like a platonic ideal of like a good, bad movie. Like,
yes,
it's fun. It's harmless. It's, even though Johnny does a bunch of like creepy stalker shit, it's fairly harmless. And again, like, I can't help but feel somewhat sorry for Vanilla Ice watching it.
I'm gonna say I will never feel sorry for somebody who makes $1 million.
Well, he lost most of it.
That's, well, I could feel bad for his poor decisions then. But he made $1 million for a man who, unless my eyes deceive me, has not had any formal acting training. He was paid $1 million for that performance. So I don't feel bad for him. And, like, again, he's part of a movie that is a lot of fun. And part of the reason it's fun is because of his performance.
Absolutely. All right. We're going to talk about the soundtrack here in just a second. But real quick, before we get to the soundtrack, I do want to mention that there is a Patreon for the show now, which you can subscribe to over at www.patreon.com/soundtracker. So for as little as $3 a month, you get to know that you're helping keep this show going, and you get some bonus content as well. For $6 a month, you'll get 2 bonus episodes, which will be coming very shortly. And then following June, they will be on a bi-weekly schedule. So this month's are already set. We've got Transformers the movie, the 1980s one, not the Mark Wahlberg or Shia LaBeouf ones, and Tank Girl with Scott Benson, who's coming back, fan favorite from Batman Forever. So you don't want to miss those. Get signed up. And like I said, this is entirely self-funded. So that helps keep this going, and I appreciate every one of you. Okay, let's talk about the soundtrack. So I don't know whether to apologize to you for making you suffer through this album even once. I almost sent you an email the first time that I listened to this. It might have just caught me at the wrong time, because I'm going to say up front that, like, I've heard worse soundtracks on here. Roadhouse was worse. Honestly, it's not even that this soundtrack is bad. What struck me is how average a lot of it is. There's not really a song on here that's oppressively bad, although there's definitely one on here that's pretty damn bad.
Yeah.
But there also weren't any that are that great. There's one that comes close to being like a pretty good song, but I never felt like I was suffering listening to it. But I think maybe the first time I listened to it, it was just like, holy shit, I just made someone sit through this.
Yeah, I mean, well, part of it is like, you know, I haven't seen the movie in a month or two, and listening to the soundtrack certainly jogged my memory of some of those scenes. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You like this is a movie that came out in the 90s, and the 90s was the heyday for soundtracks, and I'm sure you've listened to some of the good ones. Man, like Set It Off, Tank Girl, man, so many good soundtracks.
You have similar tastes. I love Set It Off. Set It Off is one that I'm hoping that I do hear soon. Felix Biederman, that was like the first one we talked about doing, and like I really want to cover Set It Off.
Set It Off has Don't Let Go by En Vogue in it, right?
Yes.
Oh, what a fucking banger, man. Hell yeah.
I know. I'm recording Tank Girl in like a week.
Yeah, Tank Girl, like, yeah, the 90s had a ton of these great soundtracks. Like, you mentioned The Crow. What a soundtrack.
Batman Forever.
Batman Forever, great soundtrack. And I mentioned Judgment Night before. Like, Judgment Night, like, predated the new metal, rap metal movement. And there's some really weird artifacts on that album.
Yeah, it was a tremendous time. Now, you're going to come across ones, though, because, again, with this being a show where I have an extensive number of movies to cover, you know, I did Major League. I just love the movie Major League and wanted to talk about Major League.
Sure.
Major League soundtrack was surprisingly not bad. I was expecting
it's all
to
like
be
Wild Thing and Money Money and shit like that.
it's like Lyle Lovett's on there.
Yeah. My relationship with Major League is my childhood friend loved it so much that we basically, there's a summer where we basically watched it every day. He loved it so much. This is also a kid who did not like watching the television show Roseanne. This was before Roseanne's current political issues. He didn't like watching the show Roseanne because he called it a bum show. Not a fan of blue collar content, I guess.
Yeah, and being from Ohio, Major League was a special one to me too.
Yeah.
But you know, the whole point of this is thank you, Stuart, for like sitting through the soundtrack even once, because you had seen the movie before. And I guess the caveat here was that I'm going to make you suffer through the soundtrack as well. But you love the movie, so there was no suffering. Mm-hmm. There.
No, yeah. During my workout today, the Cool as Ice soundtrack was my companion.
That's so funny you say that, because that's oftentimes, and I've said on that here before, that I listen to these a lot when I'm at the gym. At my gym, it plays over a speaker system, but I go to a really small gym, so a lot of the times I'm the only one there, but there's always that chance that someone's going to come walking in. And
that's insane.
I've had people walk in while I'm listening to like Kiss from a Rose. And I mean, it's all people I know, and they know that I'm doing the show at this point, but it's still just funny to have someone walk in when I'm listening to like song 6 off of this. So, but yes. Yeah, that's where I listen to stuff too, is oftentimes at the gym or when I'm out taking a walk. And I never at any point felt like I've got to turn this off or I'm going to go insane. So like, that's like, I guess the best compliment that I can give the soundtrack as a whole.
Yeah. It's a nice 45 minutes.
Yeah. And it's short and sweet. Yes. It gets in and out. So, all right. So some background on this, the soundtrack released October 8th, 1991. It debuted at number 168, which again, that had to have been a sure sign, like, because this came out a little bit before the movie. So when they saw how the album was selling, they had to have probably been like, oh shit, because To the Extreme sold 15 million albums 1 year prior.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And it peaked at number 89. So like it did gain some off the strength of the couple of singles off of this. But the top 10 the week that this came out, it's always so weird going back to like late 80s, really early 90s, because it was such a strange time in music, like pre-Nirvana and pre-like, you know, there's a couple of good rap albums on these occasionally, but oftentimes it's this kind of list that we're getting right here. So
okay,
number one was Garth Brooks' Rope in the Wind.
Okay.
Number two is Garth Brooks, Use Your Illusion. I'm sorry.
Wow. That's more of a Chris Evans album, to be honest with you.
Number two was Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 2. Get that right that time.
I mean, that album is fucking great.
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. Number three was Motley Crue's Decade of Decadence.
Okay.
Number four is another banger. Prince of the New Power Generation's Diamonds and Pearls.
Yeah, that's great.
Number five was Metallica's self-titled album.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Black Album.
Yeah, Black Album. Yeah, yeah. Number six was Public Enemy's Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black, which is another great one.
Okay.
Yeah, if you like Public Enemy, it's a post their big prime, but it was still pretty good.
Okay.
Number seven was Mariah Carey's Emotions.
Okay.
Number eight was Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1.
Yep, you gotta have them both.
Number eight was Bryan Adams' Waking Up the Neighbors.
Yeah. That's the cover that one. He's got a megaphone, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Did you own that, or did you just remember seeing it? Again, we're the same age here. So like seeing it when you're walking through the record store.
I saw it in the record store. I never bought it. I think I'm trying to remember what my record store was, because I remember they organized the CDs based on where they were charting.
Okay. See, the record store in my town was music for a small town. We had a mall that had a surprisingly great record store, and like it was Musicland at one point, and then it became Sam Goody, and they would do that. They'd had their like charting albums up front when you walked in, then alphabetical order once you got further back.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I feel like when I was this age, you know, I was interested in stuff that was popular, but I didn't listen to a ton of music. I didn't seek out a lot of music. You know, I think my first album was like Weird Al off the Deep End, I think, was the first CD I ever bought. And then it took me a few years before I started, you know, listening to a lot of, you know, like grunge and alternative and stuff like that. I didn't really discover heavy metal as being my thing until much later, when I realized that, you know, because when I was a teenager, I'm like, I didn't look like the prototypical like heavy metal dude, like your long haired Heshers. So I thought it wasn't quite for me. And then it wasn't until later that I'm like, oh no, that's actually all I want is that stuff.
What got you into metal? What was the album that did it?
Like extreme heavy metal, would be, it's Carcass Necroticism is no question. Yeah. That it's still a top five record of mine. It's great. It's like, if you want to show somebody what death metal sounds like, and it's still like somewhat approachable, Necroticism by Carcass. Thumbs up.
All right. And then closing out the top 10 was another Garth Brooks album, No Fences. So,
wow. Yeah. Nothing but GNR and GNB.
And then I'm going to explain this little feature one last time, because it's still fairly new to the show, but I'm doing, in place of like this day in history, I'm doing further down the chart now. And what I'm doing is picking three albums that never cracked the top 10, just to give an idea of, you know, when we talked about, I said that it debuted at number like 189 or whatever and climbed to number 89.
Yeah.
This album probably ended up moving. It might've gone gold. It might've moved 500,000 units, because back in the day you had to sell a shit ton of albums to crack the top 10. So I'm picking three albums that never cracked the top 10.
What's the year? When is this? What year is this?
1991.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm glad to talk about 91. Let's go.
So number 52 was Digital Underground Sons of the Pea, which only peaked at number 44.
Okay.
Number 71 is Tribe Called Quest's Low End Theory, which only peaked at number 45. That one was surprising to me. I thought that Low End Theory might have made it, maybe not top 10, but I'm surprised it only got up as high as 45.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And at number 119 is Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger, which only peaked at number 39.
Oh, wow. Only peaked at number 39, huh?
Yeah, that's. I'm kind of glad that I started pulling this out, because like the first episode I did it on was Everclear So Much for the Afterglow, only peaked at like number 21. Like, it's like all albums that people, almost everyone listening is going to know somebody who owns one of these albums.
Yep.
They somehow never, ever sold enough to crack the top 10. But again, you had to sell a ton of albums to make it in the top 10.
I'd also like to point out that previously mentioned Necroticism by Carcass came out in 1991 alongside Human by Death and War Master by Bolt Thrower, which are kind of three of the best death metal records of all time. So 91 was a pretty good year for music.
Oh, yeah. I mean, going through those Billboard charts when I pull those up to like find these is such a fun little trip when I like scroll through and look at what all's on there. A lot of the problem is the top 10 tends to be the same. Like if you get to like 95 to 97, you're going to see Hootie and the Blowfish and Alanis Morissette somewhere in there. So it's just a way to show, yeah, like how varied music was around this time and just how many great. It's such an old man, like look what they took from us sort of thing. Admittedly.
Well, it's also because of the way that like, music seems to be both more, yeah, you know, like the stuff that becomes popular seems more there's a smaller pool. But as somebody who listens to a lot of weird stuff, there's a ton of music being put out every week. Much more so, I'm sure, than was being put out in 1991. I'm sure, like, I feel like I read over at the my favorite heavy metal blog is the Black Market over on Stereo Gum, and they always have, it's a monthly breakdown of some of the best new tracks. And there was a breakdown of how many like new death metal bands were formed like this year. And it's just so crazy how many more bands are putting out like music that you can buy. Like I could buy it right now. And I feel like even 10 years ago, like if I wanted to get like, I'd have to order CDs from like other countries, but now it's all readily available to purchase online. I don't know.
You know, I always feel weird when I get into metal conversations because I do like metal, but like if, you know, I've always said this, if I'm doing like a tier, like a hierarchy of stuff that I listen to, you know, metal probably sits somewhere in the middle, but I'm also not like, as far as like subgenres go, like black metal, death metal, like I never know my shit. So like I've talked to metal fans and I'm like, oh yeah, as far as like death metal, and I'll name a band and they're like, well, they're actually, and then put them in another subgenre. But
I'd be like, blah, blah, blah. I'm a nerd. I'm making you feel bad.
Yeah. Cause I almost said like, you know, I was going to mention how much I like Converge and Dillinger Escape Plan and stuff. Like they're awesome. But then, you know, I don't know if I was going to get like the, well, actually,
I mean, they're definitely metal bands. And they're both definitely extreme heavy metal bands. Do you want to do more subgenres?
No, that's good. That's good. I just didn't want to sound dumb.
It's one of those things where like I feel like obviously heavy metal attracts a certain type of huge nerd, and I'm one of those types. And I don't know, like when I approach a lot of pop culture and art, I go down rabbit holes, and I feel like I'm already so deep into heavy metal that like I'm scared about going down deep rabbit holes in other forms of music.
You're like me though. I get constantly sucked into rabbit holes for things. For me, it's like, typically for me, it's like weird shit, like Italian horror subgenres or something along those lines. But yeah, I'm the exact same way. So before we get to the one last question, as far as your music tastes go. So again, I didn't know what you listened to before I put you through this soundtrack. Do you listen to a lot of rap music at all, or is it not something you listen to much of?
I mean, I don't listen to much, but I don't know. I have a little bit of a background. Like during high school, I like listened to, you know, like Outkast and Mobb Deep and stuff like that. Like I listened to a fair amount of, but I don't seek it out as much as I used to. I don't know. I feel like part of it is that I also like, I feel like rap music is like a slightly more, I guess, commercial friendly form of music than heavy metal, but it's like just as nerdy. Like it's like it has as many deep, weird, spiraling rabbit holes of performers.
Oh, absolutely. And like, you know what? First of all, you get immediately a huge pass for mentioning Mobb Deep, because that's, hey, Mobb Deep are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
The thing about rap too, like I don't listen to as much new stuff as I once did, but the thing about that is rap is one of those that's constantly changing. Like it literally is always like shifts and it changes. And I'm a 41-year-old white guy, so like it's not necessarily always supposed to be for me. I have people who get like mad about that, like friends that are my age that are like, well, rap isn't as good as it used to be. And it's like, you're 41, you're a white guy in the Midwest. Like it's not supposed to be for you. Like chill the fuck out.
And it's also like, it's also different. I feel like for the most part, there's a yearning toward old school stuff when it comes to heavy metal. Even if there's elements of progression, there's always a backwards looking element to it. Obviously I could be wrong. People could take me to task. But I feel like rap has a tendency to be, from my limited perspective, seems to be more like moving forward, more changing. I don't know.
No, and you're right. But the thing is, it's also cyclical, because in a few years, there could be a bunch of people that are like, you know, grew up during Kanye's heyday that want to go back to like early 2000s sort of Kanye sound. So it does that shit.
Okay. So it's a little like heavy metal. It's a little like, oh, there was this one Finnish band who released a single record in the 90s, and it seems to have inspired dozens of 20-year-olds now.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's probably true of all music.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so the first song on this album is Vanilla Ice with Naomi Campbell. Yeah. Cool as Ice, Everybody Get Loose. So this song was a minor hit. It peaked at number 81 on the Billboard charts. For the life of me, I couldn't find this. I tried to track this down. How Naomi Campbell ended up on the soundtrack or in the movie in general, because she had I understand how she ended up in the movie. I mean, she was a model. Yep. She had a small singing career, but that wasn't until a few years after this came out. So how that whole thing happened, I'm not sure. But as far as this song goes, I think it almost tries to make you feel like you're listening to a Michael Jackson song at first, because there's a very similar ooh right before it starts. But, you know, we talked about this earlier. This is not a bad song. I think Naomi does a great job on the chorus. She has a great voice. The lyrics are whatever, but, you know, Ice has a decent enough flow.
And the music reminds me a lot of like an It Takes Two type thing. Like, what is it? Eric B and Rakim, is that it? The like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like the horns are nice. It's catchy. Honestly, I feel like this could have been a bigger single had it not come out when he was already well into his like downward trajectory. Like, had this come out like a month or so after Ice Ice Baby, I feel like this probably would have been like a top 10 charting hit.
You're right. You're 100% right.
Okay, so up next is Lonnie Gordon's Gonna Catch You. So this was a soundtrack original, but it later appeared on her album Bad Mood. So Lonnie Gordon was in, this is a genre I learned about very recently, but there's a genre called high energy, and it's spelled high NRG.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's like a dance, dance is a music I don't know much about, but it's like a subgenre of dance music. And Lonnie had a few hits in the 90s, most notably Happening All Over Again. And this one actually charted as a single, but it wasn't until it was on her own album that it came out on. It didn't get released as a single off of the soundtrack, but it was produced by Black Box, who were this Italian house music group that were pretty big in the 80s and 90s. So my first thought when I heard this song, and again, you being my age, you probably know what I'm talking about. My first thought was, this is an Elder Beerman song. So like, if you were out shopping with like a parent, and you know, when you were a kid at the mall, like you just wanted to go to like the cool stores, but like you'd have to go to, and I'm not talking like a JCPenney song. Elder Beerman had the music that like told you this ain't JCPenney, you know, like they were trying to appeal to like younger parents. And this reminds me of being in the mall, like with my mom or a family member as a kid, when I just wanted to go to a cool store in the mall. And this would be something that was playing over the speakers, like lyrics inaudible at the time, but like all I could hear was the beat. Now, with that said, that's not an insult.
No, and I feel like there's a little bit of like, for whatever reason, it made me think of like Miami club music. Like there's a certain, I don't know if it's salsa or samba or some kind of a beat there that makes me associate it with Miami.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lonnie has some pipes. Like, she can sing.
Yeah.
And it's catchy. So yeah, it's, again, you know, I went into this dreading it, and so far we've got, you know, it's will I listen to this song ever again after we do this episode? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Unless you go into the mall.
Up next is Derek B's You've Got to Look Up, which was originally released as a one-off single in 1990. Derek B has one album, and it was called Bullet from a Gun. He released it in 1998, and he had two hits in the UK with Good Groove and Bad Young Brother. Now, while his career wasn't long, he actually made quite a mark in the UK because he was the first UK rapper to achieve crossover success. And you mentioned Eric B and Rakim earlier. He went on to produce and produced with Eric B and Rakim. So,
okay.
Yeah, he passed away in 2009, unfortunately. But so this song actually kind of feels like Snap's Power, but like with a lower energy level. Like, you know, I got the power. And
yes,
something about it reminds me of that. But I actually like this one. It eventually got a certain point listening to this album, because I usually go through them like 5 or 6 times before I do the show.
Yeah.
And I would skip certain songs after about a minute or so on this. And this one is one that, like, I always played it straight through when I would come across it. So I think that's a fair compliment to give it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So up next is Partners in Crime and Debbie Cole's Love to Love You, which is another soundtrack original. So do you know where else you know these guys from?
No.
Okay. So they never released an album, but their claim to fame is the song Turtle Power from the first Ninja Turtles
movie. Oh, hell yeah. Okay.
T-U-R-T-L-E, which was actually a pretty big hit when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they spell their name Partners and K-R-Y-M-E. So I learned this on Wikipedia. Crime is spelled that way because it's an acronym that stands for Keep Rhythm, Your Motivating Element. So
perfect.
In 2015, just for the hell of it, they released another Ninja Turtles theme song on their YouTube channel called Rock the Half Shell. But as far as this song goes,
I can't believe you can't just drop that and then walk away. What? How's that song?
You know what? I meant to check it out. This is why I jumped ahead.
Sure.
It's because I had a feeling I was going to get asked that, and I didn't listen to it before the show. I meant to, and I forgot until I got to that point.
Okay.
But yeah, I wish that I had checked it out, because I as soon as I read the name, I'm like, fuck, I forgot to listen to it, because I do want to hear how it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of nowhere, they're like, we're going to put another Ninja Turtles song out. But I like this one. The chorus is good. Verses are fine. But the thing about this one is, it's one that I forget almost immediately after it was over. Like, I can't remember what it sounded like.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, other than just remembering the sample. And then I think what part, like maybe the outro, he's rapping L-O-V-E to L-O-V-E-U.
Yep. Yep. Those are the two things that really stick with you. But the rest of it is basically just like lost to time as soon as it's over.
Yeah.
Okay, so up next is another Vanilla Ice track, The People's Choice, which is a soundtrack original. So this one actually suffered.
Features another big sample. It's a Kool & the Gang sample, right?
Yeah, good. You know what? That's crazy, because you did your research, or you noticed it from hearing it in the song. I don't know if it was you recognized the sample immediately or what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like that one's pretty clear.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, great sample. The problem is, so this is one that I like enjoyed a lot more until I watched the movie last night.
Oh, okay.
His performance in the movie is so low energy that that's all I can think about when I hear it now. Like, he looks like he's going to fall asleep while he's performing, and so does the crowd. And it wasn't until after that that I realized that, like, the beat is pretty boring on this one. Yeah. Despite that good sample, the beat's fairly boring. And, you know, there's no saving it with that beat. It's not really Vanilla Ice's fault, but production let him down on this one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think you're right.
Okay, so up next is another Vanilla Ice track, Never Want to Be Without You. This is the one when I said that there's one that's, like, real close to bad.
Yeah, this is the love theme of Cool as Ice.
Yes, it's just embarrassing. Like, he doesn't work at all doing like a sultry love rap song. Like, it just does not work with him.
No, it's, yeah.
He's like whispering. Like, that's how he, like, that's his like sultry voice, his sexy voice is whispering. And the guy in the chorus kind of sounds like Michael McDonald. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't find a credit for who that was doing the never wanna be without you. It is not good.
Yeah, no, thumbs down on that one. Not a fan.
Now, this one, Danu and Temples Forever, this was actually like probably the one I like the most on here. And the thing is, I can't find a fucking thing on either of them. You go to their Discogs page, they're like, the Discogs is where I always go to when I can't find anything on somebody, because at the very least you can like see whether they had anything else out.
Yeah.
Danu's only release is this song on his Discogs page, and Temple had an EP that came out in 2010, which is weird, like 20 years later.
Also weirdly, a song about the Ninja Turtles.
Everyone on this graduated to doing Ninja Turtles.
I do love the idea of somebody who's like, well, we haven't had a hit in a long time. Let's get back to basics. Let's do what we do. What we do is Ninja Turtle stuff.
Well, it's you know what? That's a gambit that could pay off at some point.
Yes.
As we said earlier, Ninja Turtles have had such a long life. Maybe, look, let's get together after this show and come up with a Ninja Turtles song. That's our plan. We could come up with a hit.
Yeah, I mean, you should go on Howl's show Fast Track and do a Ninja Turtles song.
That's true. I'm going to run that idea by you. So this is, as far as like production and everything goes, I feel like this is probably the most interesting song on here. Like, it's got that like noir movie horn at the beginning, and then there's that like weird sort of warbly beat.
Yeah.
It's kick in, and it all comes together really well.
Yeah, it's if I recall correctly, it's the one that like makes me think of almost like late night Zalman King movie type music.
Yes. Yeah, that's perfect.
Like 90s like sex thriller music.
Yeah, it's absolutely that. Like Danu does this weird chant the whole time, you know, or it's like, yep. I don't know. I actually quite like this one. It was way more interesting than anything else on here. Up next is Rosala's Faith, which is, again, soundtrack original. It was a minor hit when it was released, although it appeared on her 1992 album, Everybody's Free, but they changed the title to Faith in the Power of Love. They expanded the title from Faith to Faith in the Power of Love. And it actually became a hit on that album as well due to the strength of her previous song, because she had two pretty big hits in the early 90s called Born to Love You and Everybody's Free. So, but the thing is, she failed to recapture any of that success on later albums.
Yeah.
So we almost made it through an album made in the late 80s, early 90s without a big time saxophone solo, but this one delivers.
Yeah, it does.
Now, the thing is, it's pretty much mostly right up front, and it's not too obtrusive when it pops up later in the song. And that's the thing. I also like this one a lot too, because it's so of its time. Production wise, it's so of its time. But Rosala had a great voice.
Yeah. Yep.
And I kind of like how the lyrics are about how life will beat the shit out of you, but love will get you through. Like, I can get behind that. I'm a positive guy now.
It is kind of interesting how the front half, unlike my first listen, the front half kind of stood out as being the more upbeat stuff, but the more interesting stuff comes into the back half of the record. But we'll see.
No, you're right. The serious stuff comes towards the back. So number nine is Stanley Clarke's Drop That Zero. So look, Stanley Clarke's done a ton of great score work. He did the score for Boys in the Hood, which I talked about when I did my Boys in the Hood episode. Is a lot of times a score song, if it's placed at the very end of the album, like that's the last song in the album for me, is whatever came before it.
Yeah.
His Boys in the Hood song is so good that I would listen to it every time. Like it's actually one of my favorites on the entire soundtrack. But he's done stuff like Higher Learning, Romeo Must Die, Undercover Brother. He's done a whole bunch of score work. This one definitely feels pretty phoned in for his, you know, I know what he's capable of, you know, I know what he can do.
Yes.
I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Like, I just imagined him meeting the director and being like, give me some snippets of dialogue from the movie. And then he pumped it out in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But he probably knew what he was working with, and I'm not mad at him for it.
Yeah. He was probably like, let's just crank this one out. It'll be fine.
Give me my paycheck.
Yep.
All right. So number 10 and the final song of the album is Vanilla Ice's Get With It, which is a soundtrack original. I actually like this one too. I think if you put Vanilla Ice in front of some decent production, he could do okay. And this one has pretty decent production. It's got that air raid siren. Now, I do feel like as long as you don't think too hard about this, it's good. But he sounds like he's trying to do Public Enemy, which makes it worse if you think about it.
Yes.
But I just chose not to. And it's certainly better than the previous two contributions they had on here. That really shitty love song and People's Choice.
People's Choice. Yeah, this is the stronger one. And this is also the one they close the movie out with, which I think is probably a smart choice, right? Is this what he's singing in the like the final performance while his new girlfriend is in the audience?
Yeah. They basically try to do the ending of Purple Rain, where it's like him on stage performing in front of a crowd.
Yes, but it's not as good of a movie as Purple Rain, which is and saying something. They're both good, but Purple Rain's better. And arguably Prince is, I don't even think I have to argue, Prince is a better performer. If anyone disagrees with me, I don't know. You need to take a long look at yourself.
No, you're not going to find Prince like my favorite person who ever lived. So you're not going to find any disagreement on my end.
And I feel like this, if I recall this like last concert sequence, like it really highlights what a good dancer Vanilla Ice is.
No, you're not wrong. I think that if Vanilla Ice had come out a decade later, he probably would have had. Vanilla Ice could be Post Malone now if he'd come out 20 years later.
Yeah. I feel bad that his like way to try and weather the negative reaction is to like make himself blend in with the new metal scene, which is so much more boring than what he was bringing.
Like, okay, so you know about the new metal album.
Yeah, of course. And like the way he kind of like he grew his little goatee, he like cut his hair short. He tried to like lose what made Vanilla Ice Vanilla Ice. And the thing is, like, that stuff was that part wasn't necessarily the problem.
Yeah, it was just, I think, I don't know. I'm surprised the new metal album is not, you know, it's not like it was like a huge seller. That's why I was surprised you knew about it. It's not like it like set the world on fire when it came out or anything. It wasn't a comeback. So it's really bad, though.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Like, he did a, like a new metal cover of Ice Ice Baby, and it sucks.
Yeah, it's fucking terrible. Yeah. Like, similar to the way we talked about, like, this movie has never kind of received the, like, cultural reevaluation or reappraisal. I am not a big believer in the current trend of new metal, like, reappraisal, where, like, people are looking at their new metal and being like, actually, it's really good. I don't believe that. I don't agree with it.
I don't either, but I feel more comfortable talking about the fact that I did like shit like $3 Bill, Y'all by Limp Bizkit when it first came out in this day and age.
Yeah, you can say that now. I don't agree with you, but that's, you can say it now. People, you'll find some ears that are not against you.
Well, no. I'm not saying that new metal deserves a reevaluation by any means. I'm just saying, at least I can admit that when I was a like 17 year old kid or whatever, like I enjoyed that album and like Korn and shit, but like I haven't listened to it in years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of how I am with like the Insane Clown Posse. When I was in like high school, I was a big fan of the Insane Clown Posse, and I don't listen to them anymore, but I don't have anything against them. And the time I saw the Insane Clown Posse perform at a stadium in Toledo, Ohio, near you, it was one of the best concerts of my life. For like a 15-year-old Stewart, it was the most naked women I'd ever seen in one place.
Yeah, I have an interesting relationship with ICP. I actually still have a soft spot for ICP because I grew up 90 minutes from Detroit. So like in Ohio, we didn't have a local music scene. We didn't have a local rap scene.
Yeah.
New York, California. And Detroit had this interesting scene. You had like Esham, Nottis, ICP. There was like all this stuff out of Detroit that like, in my high school, a lot of dudes were really into it. This is like pre-Juggalos. Like there wasn't like ICP was like this weird band who put out newsletters and shit.
Yes. I remember their old website.
Yeah. And I've never seen them live. And do you want to know why? Because I have this really strange phobia of this. Not even list. There's like a phobia website that has every phobia known to man. Like, and the one that I have is not on there, but I had cannot stand being sticky. Like if someone poured honey on me, I would faint.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
The idea of being covered in Faygo for like 90 minutes. I'd love to see them live, but like I can't because I would die 10 minutes into the show once I got hit with like red pop in the face. Like,
yes, you'd get covered in red pop. Yeah. Covered in Faygo. Yeah.
But as awesome. You saw him 15. So that would have been like what, Malenko or something, or Riddlebox era.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Malenko.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I think it's cool that people can admit to liking them now too. Like that was like a big thing where like people wouldn't be able to admit that. Like at one point I liked ICP. Like that was something that like you would never admit like 10 years ago.
I remember admitting to it and getting shit for it, but it was one of those things where it's like, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. It might not have been something I would lead with.
All right, so that's the soundtrack. Let's do a quick little wrap up here and we'll call this a day. So songs in the movie that were not on the soundtrack, there were actually quite a few. The Covergirls Funk Boutique, The Bob Sittin' in Limbo, Vanilla Ice had two, Rocks the Box Parts 1 and 2. Stanley Clark had another song called Clarinet Polka. Drew Levin and Jeff Bova had Everybody Everybody. Daisy D had a song called Crazy. Now this one, Denise Lopez had two. One is It's My Heart That's Breaking, and the other is I Want to Know You, the latter of which actually appears more than any other song in the movie. It's like the songs that all soundtrack Kathy when she's around. And it actually found radio play success from being in the movie, despite the fact it never appeared on the soundtrack.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know how. I mean, it wouldn't have fit the tone of the soundtrack, so I get why it didn't make it. But it, like I said, it also appears in the movie more than any other song. So is it on Spotify? Only three songs from this album are on Spotify. Everybody Get Loose, Get With It, and Gonna Catch You. The rest are absent. However, like all of these Spotify playlists, it actually has a few of the songs that I mentioned that were not on the soundtrack, but in the movie on the playlist. So if you're a completionist, Cool as Ice completionist, you're going to have to look elsewhere, but you can find some of the missing stuff on there.
Yeah, you can get the Twilight Zone theme there.
Yeah, that was one that appeared on there too. It's in the credits. Okay, so Stuart, the movie, would you consider this an essential? Would you say stream it or would you say skip it?
I feel like this is a tough question to ask. I don't know. Like, I feel like if... It depends on you. If you are a person that like seeks out kind of interesting, weird, arguably bad cinema, this is an essential movie. Watch it with friends, watch it with an audience. It's going to be fun. It's a weird one to like watch on your own. So avoid that.
You have pretty much the exact same answer that I had. Like I had, I say stream it at least, but I did say with like an addendum to that, that if you have a soft spot for movies that, as I said earlier, aren't good in the classical sense, it's essential. Like you, I cannot believe as many like bad movie lover people as there are that have probably not seen this one, and fix that if you are one of them, because it's a really fun time.
Yeah. If your local theater is doing a bad movie night, and are screening this one, go to it. It will be fun.
All right. So the soundtrack, would you consider the soundtrack an essential? Would you say stream it, skip it, or cherry pick it?
You know, I'm going to say a skip. I think there's some, it's fine, but I feel like a lot of my affection for it is tied in with my affection for the movie rather than the quality of the soundtrack.
Yeah, I had the same thing. You could just skip this one. Even though I do feel like there's a few tracks that I'd say are worth cherry picking, like you could just skip this one altogether.
Yeah.
So do the two go well together, the soundtrack and the movie?
Yeah, I mean, they're both like high energy, weird, very specific 90s snapshots. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you're actually the recipient of a new question I'm asking at the end.
Uh-oh.
It's actually somewhat similar to the last question, but since this show has become just as much movie oriented as soundtrack oriented, and since there's so many movies with soundtracks, now this one is a pretty easy answer. You get an easy one at least. Does this movie deserve or need a soundtrack?
Yeah, of course. It's a movie starring a musician. It deserves a soundtrack.
That's so funny, because in my notes here, my answer is yeah, of course. So
yeah, of course.
Answered exactly the same. Yeah, of course it does. There are plenty that probably do not as I go through this, but for the first one, you know, you got a pretty easy one here. It's about a motorcycle rebel who wins a town over with his rap skills. Of course it needs a soundtrack. Like,
yeah.
Okay, so what are your top three songs on this album?
Man, I don't know. This is harder. Let's see. I will say probably You've Got to Look Up, Forever. I like that one. And then the title track. Those are my top three.
Okay. We have a very similar list. Mine is The News Forever at number one. Number two is Vanilla Ice's Cool as Ice, Everybody Get Loose. The only difference was I had Rosala's Faith at number three. So okay. Fairly similar list. All right. So further watching, further listening, and we'll close this off. I'm going to stick with sort of campy movies. So first one I'm going to pick, now before anyone turns this off and gets mad, let me state that this movie is a genuinely good movie, but it's also admittedly very campy. But I'm going to go with The Last Dragon, since there's a musicality sort of thing to The Last Dragon as well. Masters of the Universe, Miami Connection, and I'm going to go with it, even though it doesn't remotely relate to Cool as Ice, my favorite So Bad It's Good movie, which is Demons at the Door, and I will name drop that movie at any opportunity that I'm given. It's my first chance to mention how much I love.
I've never seen it. That sounds great. What is it?
I will send you a trailer on Twitter after we get off of here. Oh my God, it's so funny. We talked about ICP. So back in college, we used to do bad movie nights constantly. We'd go pick out like the worst looking shit we could find at the video store. Uh-huh. And this movie had this like really terrible cover. It said Music by the Insane Clown Posse at the time, where I was too cool for Insane Clown Posse. And so we were like, fuck yeah, let's get this. Okay, so the main character looks like a living version of Powdered Toast Man from Ren and Stimpy. It is about this group of Marines that dig up demons from hell while they're in like Afghanistan or something. And like within the first 2 minutes of the movie, the guy that looks like Powdered Toast Man tears his shirt like Hulk Hogan and starts yelling at a terrorist with a bomb strapped to his chest. It is incredible. People fighting like rubber dummies, insane clown posse songs playing while they do it. Really terrible attempts at comedy. It is a fantastic movie. I will shoot you the trailer as soon as we get done here because it is great. Further listening was kind of hard with this because like in the context, I don't know anything about anyone on this album. So I'm going to go with another soundtrack from the same year that ties in well with this. And that is, if you like this soundtrack, listen to Ninja Turtles 2 Secret of the Ooze soundtrack, because they're fairly similar and they've got Vanilla Ice on them.
Okay. Wow.
So, you're a bad movie connoisseur. Is there anything you thought of watching this that like might sort of scratch this same itch for you that you would think of?
Ooh, man, I don't know. That's a really tough one. For like a good bad movie that's like this. I mean, again, like I feel like it reminds me more of like David Lynch stuff. Like it reminds me more of like Blue Velvet. Or like Twin Peaks. Like, oh man. Yeah, now I'm just want to talk about Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet. Like I feel like they both have, so there's something about David Lynch movies that have like an earnestness to them, and especially like Twin Peaks. And it's kind of the same thing this movie has. Like, it's almost like a childlike wonder when approaching love and things like that.
There's a positivity. I talked about that in Lynch's, like, there's like, his movies are oftentimes about like dark underbellies of like suburbia, but like there's like a loving sort of innocence to them as well. So yes. Yeah, I get what you mean. This one has the dark underbelly without trying. That's just that Johnny's a creepy stalker.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, Stuart, it's your turn. So let everyone know where they can find you off of the podcast on Twitter, your show. Let everyone know it's your turn.
Sure. Hey, it's me. I'm Stuart Wellington. I'm one of the three hosts of the Flophouse podcast. It's a podcast about movies. Check it out. We've been doing it for 14 years, so there's a bunch of them. Let's see. My wife and I occasionally record a podcast called I Know the Owner, where a couple of bar owners, us, interview other bar people. So if you're interested in the bar business at all, that's a fun place to look. And if you are interested in bars and you're in Brooklyn, New York, I own a couple of them, Hinterlands Bar and Minnie's Bar, both located in Brooklyn. Come visit. You might find me behind the bar. You might find me holding up the bar. You never know. Yeah, let's see. I feel like that's about it. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram as @FlopHouseCat. You can see all my workout videos there. Not a joke. That's all I post on Instagram is videos of me lifting weights to music. I guess when you decide to do an episode on Lords of Chaos, you can have me on and I can complain about how there's no black metal in that movie's soundtrack. It doesn't make any sense.
Hey, you know, it's funny. Every time I have someone on, there's almost always like another movie that gets brought up that like, come back for that. I was going to say Fire Walk With Me since you talked about Twin Peaks, but Lords of Chaos is absolutely one. You're welcome back anytime.
Great.
All right. Well, Stuart, awesome. Thank you so much. And I will include all the links for everything you just mentioned in the show description. So anybody who's looking, and I got a lot of people in New York and Brooklyn that listen to this. So like, hopefully, if they're not crossovers that listen to your show and already know about it, you get a couple new faces in there that could be like, I heard you talking about Vanilla Ice.
Please do. Yeah. Come by, point at me, say, I heard you talking about Vanilla Ice. And I'll be like, just order a drink, pal. Don't hassle me.
All right, Stuart, I appreciate you doing this and I appreciate you sitting through this soundtrack. And thankfully it wasn't as much of a disaster as I thought it was going to be, because I was very worried that like, this is going to be like the worst thing I ever made someone do for this show. So I appreciate it. Thank you for coming on. And everybody listening at home, I hope you all have a tremendous weekend.
Ain't no use running, ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs, the soundtrack are gonna track you down.